The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
So the trends are overwhelmingly towards much more targeted and precise, you know, bespoke messages. And you're right, this, you know, dear sir or madam, I'm, you know, selling an oil ministry share. That doesn't really, not say it doesn't matter, but, you know, A, we're blocking the vast majority, and B, users have seen this, they're hip to those games. Like, it is not the, it's not the bleeding edge. It's not what we're really concerned about. What we're concerned about is these targeted messages where the attacker will first do some research around the target. So they find out who you are, maybe using social media, they'll add some credibility, you know, zooming in on where you are, where you work, potentially people you know. They may also add credibility by siphoning information from related accounts. So one particularly disturbing trend we've seen is incorporating information from some of these high-profile breaches to add credence to their message. For example, there's famously Equifax was breached. Lots of information is there. You might receive a message that says, you know, I'm writing to you about, the person with the last four digits of their social security number, 3456.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 6th, 2018. Stories of grievous hacks, data breaches, and their fallouts have become an almost daily addition to the news cycle. On Wednesday, Ben Wittes sat down with Mark Risher, Director of Product Management for Security and Privacy at Google, to talk about how his team is thinking about current and future threats posed by malicious cyber actors. They discussed Google Advanced Protection, how Google works with targeted individuals to set up secure systems, the growing sophistication of phishing emails, and how you might be able to protect yourself. By way of full disclosure, Google is a financial supporter of the Brookings Institution, with whose cooperation Lawfare is published. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 353, Mark Risher on Google Advanced Protection.
Let's start by having you introduce yourself. Who are you and what do you do at Google?
I'm Mark Risher, and I work on everything about Google accounts. So whether it's signing up or signing in or the wrong people trying to sign in, I try to cover this across all the Google products and all our users around the world.
And are you a software engineer? Are you a accounts man? Like what are you by background?
What am I by background? So I work in product management, and what product management means is that we're trying to figure out sort of the why we're doing things. You know, what is the business need that we're trying to solve? What is it that users or people around the world are looking for? And then coordinating amongst all the different parties to make that a reality, to turn that into the product that we ship.
So a number of months ago or some time back, you guys rolled out Advanced Protection, which I have used now for some time since the last time you guys came and visited me. And I want you to start by talking us through what the problem was that gave rise to Advanced Protection.
The problem that gave rise is that there exist people in the world for whom the risk of account takeover is disproportionate, whether it is that the likelihood is particularly high or the impact should something succeed is off the charts. There is this niche population that we felt really needed to be assured they were getting the strongest protections that Google can offer. And we wanted to make it simple and easy. So really one flip of the switch and they would be in this best protected state.
All right. So what is the quality of the type of person that you feel meets that description?
It really is. It's self-identified. So we have heard from activists, from elected officials, from journalists who are protecting sources, from captains of industry, high-profile individuals of whatever stripe. They fall into those two buckets, that either they're likely to be targets or should something happen, the impact is likely to be off the charts.
And do you imagine – I mean – there are a lot of users of Google accounts.
Yeah.
Are we talking about 20% of the Google using population should be thinking about advanced protection, 2%, 0.2%? How do you imagine, just as a sort of with reference to the average Google user, what kind of universe of people we're talking about here?
It's hard to know, but with Google, we have a lot of users around the world. And so even that 0.2% is still a pretty large number. We don't know for sure what the full population is, but we'd imagine that worldwide, it's probably measured in the single-digit millions and not beyond that. That said, it's self-identified. So if people feel like they are at risk, this product is for them. It's, again, try to make it really simple that they can get into that best protected state. They can fully understand all the different access mechanisms that are available to that account and to their sensitive data. And we fully anticipate people from different walks of life, different careers, different areas that may feel that it's a fit for them, even if we never could have identified them in advance.
But there are certain people that you did identify in advance. And I know this because I was one of them. Mm. And you guys kind of went on a spree 6 months ago, 8 months ago, 10 months ago, whenever, where you kind of came to Washington, I assume you did it elsewhere, and sort of started tapping people on the shoulder and saying, hey, we want to brief you on advanced protection, how it works, what it is, because we, among other things, think you should be using it. So what was that universe of people like just around? Yeah, I mean, not asking you to identify anybody in particular, although I will.
It was just you.
It was just me. Yeah. Yeah, right. You know, when you think about the types of people who are either, as you say, at particularly high risk or at particularly high impact of the risk if it happens, you mentioned activists, you mentioned journalists, you mentioned government officials. This spree that you guys went on was in the wake of the period following the 2016 election, which of course had some elements of that, right, with the Podesta hack and the like. So what are the qualities of when you designed this that you're thinking of makes somebody kind of particularly high risk?
What we've been thinking about is it is, again, that events in the news have demonstrated the effectiveness of some tactics, techniques, and practices, that like the weaponization of data for non-commercial and even non-criminal reasons was eye-opening, not just for the lay people, but also for would-be attackers who said like, oh, that's interesting. That seems to work. And unfortunately, a lot of the press coverage of this has really focused on this like us versus them, with one specific attacking group and one specific defending group. But you can't put the genie back in the bottle. These techniques are now out there and are being attempted by many different adversaries for many different reasons. So you're right. We designed advanced protection thinking we want to make sure that we can give really powerful positive assurances, effectively make promises to users who enroll. And the categories that you listed were a few that felt like they were an obvious fit. Journalists who are protecting sources. There's plenty of stories right now of people from all different stripes going after journalists for this. Activists around the world, there's been lots of cases where people are going after them. Politicians are an obvious fit, and there's cases on that. And then just generally high profile, where high profile is still kind of a niche designation. Like there's there's Beyonce and she's high profile, but there's people that may be high profile for for more localized reasons. They're running in a particular campaign. They operate a particular business. Maybe they just have sensitive records for one thing that the attackers are going after. What we're seeing across the board is that attacks are are much more targeted, that they're going after, they know who they're looking for. And so this is where the program is pretty broad. And to kind of cap it off, you're correct. Over the 12 months that we've had advanced protection out in the field, we've been trying to find all these different groups and make them aware that it's an option. You know, it's a free product, it's a free program, but there is this difference that, you know, the vast majority of our defenses are applied evenly for all billions of our Google users. This is different. This is saying, you know, if you're that 1 million that's at highest risk, we kind of need different mechanisms to reach you. And that's where things like Lawfare Podcast fit in.
All right. So let me bring this down to brass tacks using my own case as an example. I got a call from the FBI sometime in, I think, early 2017, saying that I was of interest to a cybersecurity bad actor and they would give me no more information than that. And I assumed without knowing that we were either – it was a foreign actor of some kind just because of some aspects of the atmospherics of the call as well as – the fact that I had challenged Vladimir Putin to a fight. And that was all the information that I have. When you guys approached me and said you interested in a briefing on advanced protection, I thought, I could totally see that this would make sense for me. Is it fair to say that if you have known problems with people trying to get into your account, you are within the molten core of what this is about?
Yeah, that's fair to say. In fact, we cross-promote it with our state-sponsored alerts. So you're presumably familiar with, we issue these warning notices when we identify that someone is being targeted by state-sponsored actors. And at that point, by the time we send the alert, we've already taken a number of steps on Google's side to dial up the protections and put you into the best place. But we give these notices, one, out of an abundance of caution, and so that people are aware and can protect the other parts of their life where, you know, we may not be able to. But secondarily, to give, you know, advice, here's the steps you can take if you really want to get into the best place.
All right. So bottom line, if you're using Google, you have the option of advanced protection no matter who you are. It is specially designed for people who designate themselves as at high risk, and it is sort of up to you whether to do that.
That's right. Yes.
All right. Now let's talk about the technical problem that it is designed to address. There are a gazillion cybersecurity concerns that can lead somebody to account takeover problem. This is not about all of them. What is it about?
We really focus on three main aspects of how we can help people stay safest with advanced protection. The first one is authentication, and even more fine-grained, it's setting up a new device. So we believe the riskiest moment is when a piece of hardware, whether it's a phone, a laptop, et cetera, that we've never seen before suddenly presents itself and says, like, I want to be associated with Ben's account. To be most wonkish about that, you know, someone tries to sign in on a device we've never seen before. So at that moment with advanced protection, we require the user to have a physical key. It's a product called Security Key. We manufacture and sell some, but there's a number of other companies out there that also sell them. And this physical key has some really interesting and unique properties. First and foremost, that it dramatically changes the game when it comes to phishing. That is, when it comes to a deceptive login page that pretends to be the user. And by having this physical key, we can say you must possess this device in order to set up an account on a new piece of hardware.
All right. When people think of phishing,
yep,
they think of an email they get.
Dear sir or madam, I am a Nigerian oil minister.
And really want to give you $100 billion. And
precisely.
If you can just give me $10,000 to get the process started.
The paperwork, and then you're going to be singing in the rain.
Right. Yep. When you're talking about phishing, you're talking about something very different. And when you guys were last here, you walked me through some of the – and I've seen sort of what I thought of as – clever spear phishing emails,
yep,
but I've never seen anything like these. And so what is the state of the art that, you know, elite state-sponsored attackers are using now that other forms of security that people use on Google, regular old two-step authentication, Google Authenticator, you know, these great services that you guys provide aren't good enough for.
So the trends are overwhelmingly towards much more targeted and precise, you know, bespoke messages. And you're right, this, you know, dear sir or madam, I'm, you know, selling an oil ministry share, that doesn't really, not say it doesn't matter, but, you know, A, we're blocking the vast majority, and B, users have seen this, they're hip to those games, like it is not the, it's not the bleeding edge, it's not what we're really concerned about. What we're concerned about is these targeted messages where the attacker will first do some research around the target. So they find out who you are, maybe using social media, they'll add some credibility, you know, zooming in on where you are, where you work, potentially people you know. They may also add credibility by siphoning information from related accounts. So one particularly disturbing trend we've seen is incorporating information from some of these high-profile breaches to add credence to their message. For example, you know, there's famously Equifax was breached, lots of information is there. You might receive a message that says, you know, I'm writing to you about, you know, the person with these, the last four digits of their social security number, you know, 3456. That's gleaned from the breach. So it is effectively public information, but in the heat of the moment, you forget that and it makes it look really credible. You know, or here's the prefix of your credit card number or a few digits from your phone number. Some of these bits of info might make it feel very precise and therefore more believable. What they're trying to do is to get you panicked enough that you're going to speed through the next few steps, one of which will usually be a fake but very convincing authentication page.
Now, those fake, but you when you guys were last here, you showed me some of those fake authentication pages, and they were astonishingly good. Like, I never would have even paused over them. Right. I mean, you really have to read the entirety of the URL.
Which may not even be possible, yeah.
And furthermore, it does not just take your name and password, your username and password. It also then fronts your two-step authentication because it relays the two-step authentication information to real Google and actually logs you in. As I watched this, I thought, wow, that to the extent that that is scalable, that's kind of the end of two-step authentication. My question is, in light of those fake authentication pages being in use, how long before everyone's going to need this?
Well, so it's not the end of two-step authentication or two-factor authentication.
No, merely regular old two-factor.
Right. And yeah. Sorry. I didn't mean to contradict you, but yes, the, you know, the second factor vary in strength and vary in what they're trying to accomplish. So it is still true that giving us any second factor is going to put you into a much better protected state than not having one. And so even just giving us a phone number, which is sort of the oldest and most tried and true, does dramatically improve our chances of sending a challenge and preventing you know, certain types of low-grade attacks against the account. But that said, what you're referring to is what we'd call an active man-in-the-middle impersonation or attack. And what's happening there, as you described, is that the adversary puts up a, you know, pixel-perfect intermediate site that looks exactly like what you're trying to go to and essentially plays this game of telephone in two different directions. So the site to you, the user or the target, looks perfectly convincing, even though it's fake. It's a, you know, it's a perfect identical copy, convincing the user to put information into it, and then turns around and relays that information to the legitimate site. So you've got a user at one end of the screen. In the middle, you've got this fake site with this active adversary. And on the right-hand side, you've got the legitimate site. And if they can do this fast enough, then you are completely unaware. There's no way for the user to perceive that, you know, everything is being manipulated, tampered with, and intercepted along the way. And that goes also for any sort of information the user is expected to put in, whether it's their password on the first attempt, or some confirmation code or secondary step or a six-digit string that appears on their cell phone, all of these can be intercepted. And that's what led us to invent Security Key, which is one of the technologies at the center of the Advanced Protection Program.
All right. So walk me through how the Security Key is different from a normal garden variety two-step authentication. And also, you know, you guys have been allowing people to use security keys for much longer than advanced protection, right? What is the difference between advanced protection and just using a security key as your second factor?
So for the first one, what security key does is really it flips the problem on its head and, you know, stops asking people to do things that people are not good at. So in a regular phishing scenario, this is where someone has somehow, deceived you into visiting a fake site, a deceptive site that looks nearly identical to the real login page. What's happening in that case is that you, the user, need to study the page and look at everything there to try to ascertain if it truly is legitimate or if it's not. There's plenty of advice we put out there. Like you said, look at the URL, look for, you know, anything that feels off, look for, you know, the logos and images and typos and the copyright date being wrong. But ultimately, it's based on the person making a flawless assessment of, is this the real site or a fake one? And that is just patently difficult for human beings. We're evolved to see commonalities and patterns. We're evolved to say, you know, any one of those tigers might jump and attack me, and I'm not going to spend time hair splitting over the one with three stripes being more dangerous than the one with four stripes. But that's what has been exploited in this case, where the more close the deception is, the less likely user will spot it, and the more likely he'll fall for it. What Security Key does is it inverts that problem. It makes the site have the burden of proof. The site has to send information to the key saying, I am Google.com or I am Facebook.com or Microsoft.com or what have you. And then that information is compared to the records inside the key. And if and only if it matches, does the key effectively release its password to the site. That means that the user, the person, doesn't have to be doing anything special. They can be distracted, blindfolded, paying attention to three other things. And the key is doing the hard work, which is verifying that the site is real. And the site is the one that has to prove that it's real first.
So just to walk through what the process is, you go to Google. You type your username, you type your password as per normal, and then it gives you a challenge, produce your security key. You stick your security key in, you press the little button on the security key, and you're in.
Right.
That's it.
That's it. So it's actually one of these rare moments when we can make things more secure and actually easier. Like compared to, you know, I know it's not a lot, but memorizing these six-digit codes, it actually sometimes feels stressful to me. I'm like, okay, it's like 345192, and then I just look over here and type it in. Like this is actually easier because you just press the button.
Okay, so easier in some ways, but there are convenience issues. So first of all, as you said before, the security key option was there before advanced protection.
Right.
The innovation of advanced protection is it cuts off all other access to the account. So you can't have your phone as a backup. You got your security keys or you're not getting in.
That's right. Because what the attacker is going to do is pretend to have lost the keys. So if you had security key as an option and then a number of fallback mechanisms, I could show up at the site and say, yep, I'm Ben. Sorry, I lost my keys. You know, give me something easier. And then that defeats the whole purpose. So with advanced protection, what we've done is said security key or bust. Like that's the only option that we present for the authentication step. But to keep it from being too cumbersome and locking people out unintentionally, we've made a few additional considerations. The first is that we require you to have two of them, the theory being that losing two is harder than just losing one. So we actually package up, and you can buy on our store as well as other places, two keys, put one in a safe deposit box or give it to a family member or keep it at home. The other you can carry in your keychain, and that is, you know, better protection and redundancy. The second step is that we actually don't ask for it every single time. So people may remember when they think of authentication and high security, these little RSA secure ID tokens that had a 6-digit code that would change every minute and you had to carry this with you and you had to use it every single day. We actually think that that's overkill and that the bad usability leads to people doing kind of maybe risky other behaviors. So we deliberately do not ask for the security key every single day. And in fact, should under normal circumstances almost never ask for it.
Yeah, I've had it on my phone since the last time you guys were here, and I've never been asked for it.
And that's deliberate. So what we view, I think I said earlier, the highest risk moment is setting up a new device. So when you unbox your new phone, we have some Google products coming out next week, and you might want to find out those. So you unbox this brand new Google product, that's a risky moment because we've never seen it before. And so we're going to require the security key there to set up your account. But then from that point forward, as long as you have physical control of that device, you've now brought your threat model from everyone in the world who's on the internet down to the relatively few people that could actually pick your pocket and take your phone. And so that's where we actually rely on things like encryption and screen lock and say that's adequate and actually is a good trade-off of usability versus security.
Okay, so let's pause over that because I think there's a really interesting sort of cybersecurity observation embedded in that. If the Russians want my Gmail to embarrass me because I challenged Vladimir Putin to a fight, they are unlikely to break into the Brookings Institution and go through Brookings's physical security and into my desktop and figure out how to log into my Brookings account, call up Google, and go to Gmail. Or to rob me on the street and steal my phone and figure out how to break through Apple's security access to the device itself, they are much more likely to get a new device or one of their own devices and phish and attack through that mechanism and try to get me to screw up.
That's correct. So physical attacks are possible. Like there is a local threat. But the surface, the number of opportunities is just so much smaller that we really think of them separately. So right now, you're sitting here with me. I can see your phone. You can see your phone. We know where it is. We know who has physical control over it. So the number of people who are potentially breaking into your phone right now, we know who that is. The number of people who are potentially attempting to break into a cloud account right now is, unknowable. It's infinite because anyone around the world could be attempting. And so that's where the remote hijack attempt is something that we put a lot of attention into very cleanly delineating. And if we can ever turn a local problem where any citizen of the world can attack down to a global one, down to a local one, we feel like we've moved the ball
eliminated
quite a lot.
7 billion people.
Precisely. Exactly. Okay. So one interesting parallel of this is some bad advice that we've given for years and years and years, which is you should never write down your password. And that comes from a bygone era when people had a workstation or a mainframe that was in their office and their threat model was, the cleaning crew or people coming through the building who might see a post-it note stuck on your monitor and use that to log in. That advice no longer works in this global threat, this remote hijacking scenario, when what you're much more concerned with is that somebody's going after another site that you use the same password on, breaching that, and then using that to kind of bootstrap their way into your account. And so now actually writing it down is sort of the best advice because the alternative is something that's reused and so obvious that you can keep it in your memory. And so that's, again, this case of like staying abreast of the evolving threat models really being important for understanding what advice to take and what steps to use to defend yourself.
That's super interesting. All right. So then there's this other disadvantage from a convenience point of view, which is I used to have these other services that would tap my Gmail to provide me various services. And now when I signed up for advanced protection, they all got cut off and there's no way for them to, because they cannot produce the device itself, they can't produce the security key, there's no way to have them interface. I have just interpreted that as that's a convenience for security trade-off that I was making before, pretty unaware of it. And now I had to make a choice between the convenience and security, chose the security. My life has gone on only very mildly inconvenienced. Is that just a cost of the added security, or is there some way in the future that security keys will be, you know, as convenient as Internet of Things based refrigerators?
We're working on convenience, and actually, I forget when my colleagues came to visit you, but we've continued opening that up, just doing it very prudently and very deliberately. So we started listing the pillars of advanced protection, the first one being this authentication step and requiring security key. The second is what you're referring to here, that we did clamp down on third-party applications that can access your data. We did that with a deliberate reason, not to hamper your usability, but because, you know, as information gets passed along the chain, we wanted to know what's happening and who has their hands on it. And there's a lot of products out there that, you know, act as a mail client, but also aggregate your information and store it in different places that we didn't feel we could, you know, really include in a program that we said was the best security. So at launch time, we limited email access, that is Gmail inbox access, to a very discrete set of basically the two applications that we built, the Gmail app on web, iPhone, and Android, and the inbox app, which we've recently moved on from on the same. We have since then, though, expanded to a few other products, including the mail application that comes with the Apple iPhone that's built into the iPhone, and an open source product known as Thunderbird, which is a mail client that a lot of activists and people in the NGO space have been using. And we did that because we were able to spend sufficient time really vetting and understanding the security properties there and felt like it was worth making that trade-off. Now, it does actually lower security by a small amount because in the Gmail app, we have lots of additional warnings and triggers that we can do for security reasons. But we felt like it was more important to get people onto the correct side of the line and into this advanced protection program. So we made some concessions.
All right. So now I want to go back to where we started. Why shouldn't everybody be using this? I mean, I actually don't remember when it was precisely that I signed up for it. It has not inconvenienced my life in any significant way. The marginal cost of it is not zero in the sense that you need these keys, but they're not expensive. And I do have a great deal more confidence, rightly or wrongly, I think rightly, that other people are not accessing my accounts against my will. And I am not sure why it shouldn't be a perfectly routine matter that people think of these keys as part of thinking about, like, the way we think about passwords. And so I guess my question that I would like to end with is, why isn't at this point why is this advanced protection and not just password protection?
I think of it a little differently, but I'm really glad to hear that you haven't felt that it forced you to change your life, because we didn't want to make it miserable. In fact, we find, you know, people will not accept more security than they think they need. My visual metaphor for this is sometimes you see a picture of an apartment building where there's like three or four deadbolt locks on the door. But what you find is after a few weeks, people are just using the bottom one. It's just too much of a burden to do this on an ongoing basis. And so we didn't want to push people into, like, it's so painful that you're going to hate it. And what I see is, you know, we would love to have more people adopt this. We'd love to make sure that everyone who feels at risk is enrolling. And what we'll also be doing is pushing things to the mainstream whenever we find that they're not that painful. So if it is that security keys really aren't an impediment, we'll start rolling that out more automatically. The third pillar we haven't talked about for advanced protection is a number of in-product settings that do things like extra scrutiny on attachments someone sends you by email, or extra scrutiny on Android applications. When those could work and are palatable for the mainstream, we'll push them in that direction and then continue raising the bar on advanced protection such that we're always offering the best and the strongest, but we still want to rise the tide for the rest of our billions of users around the world.
Thank you very much for joining us. This has been super helpful and very informative.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Mark Risher for coming on the show. Please take a second to share the Lawfare podcast and give us a rating and review wherever you found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.